The Donald feuds with the Speaker, and the Senator says he's in it to win it. When will the two parties start to make nice? We'll explore that on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Now that we have time to catch our breath from this Republican presidential race, oh my God, what is going on?
If I'm Donald Trump, I'd rather have Republicans who don't like me than independents who don't like me, because Republicans could potentially come home and actually vote for me. But it is an effort for him to try and become better liked.
Plus, the contest to succeed Barbara Boxer is fast approaching. We'll look ahead to the Senate primary in California.
Harris remains the front runner at this point. She has another major Democrat and three major Republicans behind her, but she seems a sure bet to make the runoff for November.
And we remember Bob Bennett, the Utah Republican senator who died last week and who was perhaps the Tea Party's first victim.
The political atmosphere obviously has been toxic, and it's very clear that some of the votes that I have cast have added to the toxic environment. For my congratulations, as I say, to whoever wins.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 127 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Now that the battle for the two presidential nominations is in the final lap, one would think that the parties would start to close ranks. But that's not what's happening. On Tuesday night, Bernie Sanders, who has fought the good fight, who seems mathematically a long shot to, at best, to win the Democratic nod, handily defeated Hillary Clinton in West Virginia. Not long ago, the conversation was about how he can influence the platform. Tuesday night, it went beyond that.
And let me be as clear as I can be. We are in this campaign to win the Democratic nomination. And we are going to fight for every last vote in Oregon, Kentucky, California, the Dakotas.
There's no longer a contest on the Republican side. Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee, but he has yet to win over the leaders and elected officials in the GOP in his bid to succeed in November. That worries the party of Lincoln, but he says who needs him? He's gotten this far without him. That's why his feud with House Speaker Paul Ryan drew so much attention this week. It started when Ryan said he was not ready to make an endorsement. Here he is on CNN talking to Jake Tapper.
Well, to be perfectly candid with you, Jake, I'm just not ready to do that at this point. I'm not there right now. And I hope to, though, and I want to. But I think what is required is that we unify this party. And I think the bulk of the burden on unifying the party will have to come from our presumptive nominee.
Things did calm down a bit, and Trump's meeting with Ryan this week is an attempt to smooth things over. But there's never a smoothing over when it comes to Sarah Palin, who said on CNN she will do her part to take down the speaker.
I think Paul Ryan is soon to be cantered as an Eric Cantor. His political career is over, but for a miracle, because he has so disrespected the will of the people. And as the leader of the GOP, the convention, certainly he is to remain neutral, and for him to already come out and say who he will not support was not a wise decision of his.
Why do I keep quoting Sarah Palin? So with polls showing a sizable number of Republicans saying they will not be able to support Donald Trump in November, and many Democrats still on the fence about Hillary Clinton, it's clear that both parties have some fence mending to do. Not that either Trump or Clinton's nomination is imperiled. The math says that's not going to happen. Which is a good segue into this week's trivia question. Who was the last major party presidential candidate who had the most delegates going into the convention but failed to win the nomination? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch, and the winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
I'm a loser, and I lost someone who means to me. I'm a loser, and I'm not what I appear to be.
For the longest time, we would sit and watch the rise and rise of Donald Trump. A carnival act, we said at first. A celebrity attraction that is sure to disappear. Here's what Frank Newport, the head of the Gallup polling organization, said about Trump on our program back in July.
Well, keep in mind that leading at this point in a trial heat poll is basically a reflection of name ID. We're very early in the process. It's very tricky when pollsters call people up and try to read a list of 16 names and then say, now, of all those names I just read, who would you vote for if the primary was today? And it's not today. And for a lot of people, we assume the name Trump stands out and they mention his name. But when we look at it kind of coming at it a different way, we see that that Trump has a lot of negatives, a lot of baggage associated with him, even among Republicans. And we also know that when we ask Americans, is Trump a serious candidate for president? Which, by the way, we asked back in 1999, and only a quarter said yes. We just re-ask it, and only a quarter say yes. No change from 1999 when he was running before. So one thing to keep in mind is that three-quarters of Americans, all Americans, not just Republicans, say he's really not a serious candidate.
But the more outrageous things Trump said, the more lines he seemingly crossed, the higher he surged in the polls. He kept winning. As more candidates dropped out, Republican voters didn't coalesce behind any of his rivals. They went to Trump. And when voters in Indiana earlier this month failed to come through for Ted Cruz and the never-Trump forces, it suddenly became obvious. No contested convention, no second or third ballot battles. Donald Trump, proving everyone wrong, became the presumptive nominee. Aaron Blake is a political reporter with the Washington Post and the managing editor of the Post's The Fix column. Aaron, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Aaron, it's still hard to come to grips with this, and sometimes I still can't believe it that I'm saying this, but Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee for president. I don't think it really hit me until after we saw what happened in Indiana. What was your reaction to when you finally sat back and watched and saw the enormity of it all?
Well, you're right. It's still hard to believe it. There's still, 2 months to go before the convention, and I'm trying to figure out how the Republican Party is going to wiggle their way out of this. There's even a possible way right now. We even saw Ted Cruz this week say, hey, if I win Nebraska, maybe I'll jump back in. Of course, he didn't wind up winning Nebraska. This is something that is happening. We've taken a long time to come to grips with it, but it's certainly a reality now. The Republican voters have time and again turned back to this man. Basically, every demographic in the party has supported him at one time or another, and almost all of them are behind him right now. So it's been an overwhelming performance, and I think everything that Frank Newport said at the time in the clip that you played was true and was based upon a long career of studying political numbers and how they worked and what was likely to happen with them. And then the campaign actually was run, and a lot of things flipped on their head, and Donald Trump became more popular with Republicans. So here we are in a place that I think a lot of people still don't believe we are, but here we are.
Well, we heard Frank Newport from July, as you noted, and I have another classic moment from the archives from some guy named Aaron Blake from last August.
Oh, no, don't do it to me.
Donald Trump, he has a ceiling. The ceiling seems to have crept up a little bit higher in recent weeks. You know, initially he was really unpopular among even Republicans, but he has a ceiling. Once this field narrows, I think that you're going to start to see, you know, the kinds of things that he says that could alienate some Republicans come back to bite him a little bit. He can't win this race with 25%. He needs to be able to get to a majority of voters once this race really kicks into gear and once it boils down to a few candidates, if in fact he's still in the race at that point.
Aaron, I didn't play that to make fun of you, of course, because I agree with everything you said. So we're sitting there in 2015. Nobody saw it. How did we miss it?
Well, first of all, is that really what I sound like on the air? I'm not sure I appreciate that. It must be the production work that you guys are doing over there.
You sound taller than I remember you, actually.
Like I said, everything that we were talking about was rational analysis based upon our understanding of the process. A guy who, there were early polls that showed Donald Trump with two-thirds of voters in the Republican caucuses in Iowa and primary in New Hampshire, viewed Donald Trump unfavorably at the start of this process. That's a very difficult thing to overcome unless you can change people's attitudes about you. And he did that despite the fact that he was kind of a known quantity. It's a little bit harder to remove numbers once you're a known quantity and people have established a viewpoint of you. But he did it somehow. And then I think what happened in the general election is, and this is not to take anything away from Trump, but he was at 25%, and then he was at 30%, and then 35%. And all the while, there was supposed to be this kind of coming together of the alternative candidate. It never happened. The race remained pretty crowded. And when we did get that alternative candidate, it was another Tea Party outsider guy who wasn't necessarily in the mold of somebody who they thought was going to stop Trump.
Ted Cruz, who did not have highly favorable numbers either.
Right. And in fact, towards the end of the race, had worse numbers than Donald Trump did among Republicans, which is pretty telling, I think. So there were a whole lot of factors that conspired to change the overall calculation that goes into making Donald Trump the Republican nominee, and I don't think it was all a bunch of happenstance and fortunate occurrences that made it happen, but there were certain ways in which Trump got lucky here, and one of those ways was that the race stayed pretty crowded and the candidates he wound up facing in the end were maybe not necessarily the most differentiated from Trump and the most unifying, I should say, for the Republican establishment.
I understand why all this happened, and I understand that there was very little we really understood going into Iowa and New Hampshire. But even going into the May primary in Indiana, there were so many journalists, so much speculation that there was still time to stop Donald Trump. There was going to be a contested convention. There would be a multi-ballot convention. Indiana was the place it was going to be. And Indiana wasn't even close. Now, so did we not get on, were we not on the ground talking to voters in Indiana? Were journalists talking to each other? It just seemed like we were, I understand why we were so off in 2015, but we were also so way off in May of 2016. And I'm having trouble getting my arms around that.
I think you're exactly right. I think that what happened in Indiana really harkens back to the beginning of the race. When Ted Cruz was about to compete in Iowa, and after he won Iowa, you know, I and others wrote about how the coming slate of southern states that were very early in the Republican process were going to be a very good thing for Ted Cruz. He's a southern guy, obviously. He's an evangelical, which is a heavy portion of the vote in the South. The map was set up for him to take the lead early in the process, even if he didn't necessarily pass Trump in the national polls. But what we saw over the course of the race is that Cruz often underperformed in these states where he was supposed to do well. And that's certainly what happened in Indiana. He became kind of a guy who people were okay with, but they didn't feel strongly about. And a lot of Republican voters turned against him. Like I said, his numbers were worse than Trump's at the end of this process. So if not for that, could he have won Indiana? Perhaps. But that's a reality that this race wound up succumbing to. And I think that's why at the very end of this race, we saw Trump start winning huge majorities of the vote, which he didn't do until New York voted.
Obviously, the conventional wisdom has been so off all year long, and to predict what's going to happen in November is obviously a fool's errand, and we have plenty of time to make bad predictions before that.
Yeah, please don't make me.
Right, exactly. But you sound very good in your bad predictions. Your voice sounds very good in those bad predictions.
I appreciate that.
Anyway, right now the thought is that the numbers against Hillary Clinton, the presumptive Democratic nominee, do not look good for Donald Trump. The math doesn't look great. If you look at where Mitt Romney won, where he won in 2012, where McCain won in 2008, where does Donald Trump advance on those states, on those numbers? And what about his effect on the bottom of the ticket, the Mark Kirks, the Kelly Ayotts, the Rob Portmans, the Pat Toomeys, maybe even John McCain's? I mean, the Republicans running for re-election or just standing for election in 2016, they are very nervous.
Yes, they are. And I think that the Senate, first thing I'll say is the Senate is going to emerge as a key subplot here, especially if Trump can't start to narrow the gap in these national polls or in many of the swing state polls, which generally show him down by as much as double digits. We may see somewhat of a Republican retrenchment, if that's the case, where we see money starting to go towards the Portmans and the Ayotts and the open Florida Senate seat where Marco Rubio made a bad decision and decided to retire to run for president. The other thing I would say is it's one thing for Donald Trump to be a very unpopular nominee, which he certainly is. He's much more unpopular than Hillary Clinton, who is historically unpopular for Democrats. The other thing here is that Republicans are fighting uphill even if he wasn't historically unpopular. The Electoral College in recent elections has become a very big liability for Republicans in that basically all Democrats have to do to win is to win Florida and all the other states that they generally win. Democrats only have to win about a third of the swing state electoral votes in order to win a presidential election. So Republicans don't just not want an unpopular nominee. They want somebody who has a superior image to the Democrat because they probably need to win the national popular vote in order to have a chance of winning the Electoral College at this point. And so it's a lot of very difficult circumstances for Republicans, and not all of them have to do with Donald Trump, but it's certainly something that party leaders are panicking about right now, and rightly so.
You mentioned the likely general election battle between two candidates with high negatives. I saw an NBC poll not that long ago that had Hillary Clinton, I think, with 53-54% unfavorable numbers. Donald Trump was 65%. But it's fair to say, though, that within the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton's numbers are much more positive than Donald Trump's numbers are within his own Republican Party.
Right. But that also kind of speaks to how Trump could recover a little bit in the polls. His numbers are depressed a bit because there are some Republicans who still don't like him. If they come around to him, do his numbers start looking a lot closer to Hillary's? It's quite possible. And of course, you know, that's something that we have yet to see, whether the Republican Party will actually unify behind the guy. But if I'm Donald Trump, I'd rather have Republicans who don't like me than independents who don't like me, because Republicans could potentially come home and actually vote for me in larger numbers than independents. So it is an effort for him to try and become better liked. And I think that we have yet to see really if he can kind of do that charm offensive and really try to do the things that it's going to take to win over people who have decided that they don't like him still after all these months.
We keep hearing people talk about the impending doom or death of the Republican Party, that Donald Trump could very well just lead to a historic defeat, similar or akin to what Barry Goldwater went through in 1964. But, you know, when you look at history like that, whenever you think that a party is about to go, you know, the way of the Whigs or the dinosaurs, you had Barry Goldwater in 64 winning, I think, six states total. But 4 years later, Richard Nixon won. And then 4 years after that, Nixon won 49 states. The Democrats were doomed with George McGovern in 1972. They lost 49 states. And yet 2 years later came Watergate. And 2 years after that came Jimmy Carter. So we always say the party is doomed, but history shows, well, maybe not so fast. So what do you have to say about that?
Well, we've done some work on this, and the idea of kind of a realignment of political parties is something that has happened in the course of American politics, but it's generally not because of one man or one set of circumstances. It's something much larger, whether it be a war or something like that. And the main obstacle towards a political party imploding and kind of disappearing forever is the difficulty in establishing a viable third party. If Donald Trump and the Republican Party do go down in flames, another political party has to kind of fill that gap and emerge as a replacement. And generally, that's not what happens. We look back at 1912, and even we had a former president running as a third party candidate, Theodore Roosevelt, on the Bull Moose Party ticket. And even he wasn't able to really kind of penetrate the two-party system. The Republicans lost that election. In the next election, we had the same two parties that we'd had for a very long time. So I think that we tend to be caught up in the moment, much like we were earlier with Donald Trump's early candidacy, and we tend to overestimate the here and now until we see kind of a seminal historical moment. I think that the prescriptions of the Republican Party's imminent demise are pretty overblown. But again, of course, we're making predictions, and I could be on your show again in the year, once again eating these words.
I mentioned earlier Barry Goldwater, and I was thinking of all the Republicans who stayed away from his candidacy in 1964, Nelson Rockefeller, William Scranton, George Romney. But in some ways, it looks even worse with Donald Trump. You have two former presidents, both Bush 41 and 43, saying they can't support him, they won't go to the convention. Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, people like that saying no way they will support him. Do you recall, I mean, with Goldwater or McGovern or anything like that, do you recall so much antipathy among so many in the party for their presidential nominee?
I think it's different now. First of all, the Goldwater reference, you know, that was when the Republican Party, had a liberal wing to it, and it doesn't have that today. So the liberal wing was very wary of Goldwater. Today it's much more, it's not even so much the positions that Trump stakes out. I think it's just the way he conducts his campaign, the fly off the handle thing. I don't think the party is as afraid necessarily of his policies, which he may not be able to implement anyways. I think they're worried about the things he says rubbing off on them and making them look like a party that isn't all-inclusive and doesn't welcome minorities and women and things like that. I think they've got a much longer view. They know that this election is probably one that they're going to have a hard time winning, and they just don't want to do any long-term damage. So I think that's really what this is about, more so than worrying about kind of how politically extreme he is.
We keep talking about all the problems that Donald Trump and the Republicans have, but not everything is going so smoothly for the Democrats as well. The anointment of Hillary Clinton is running into some roadblocks. Bernie Sanders, of course, won this week in West Virginia. He may well win in Oregon next week. Obviously, she would love to focus on Donald Trump. I think I'm conjugating the word Trump. She would love to concentrate on Donald Trump, but she still has Bernie Sanders sticking around. How much does Sanders' ability to keep winning these primaries, how much does that hurt her efforts to be the Democratic nominee, or at least to focus on the general election?
You know, I think it certainly does not make her look like a strong candidate. The very fact that she's basically locked up this entire Democratic nomination, I mean, the math for Sanders is basically prohibitive at this point, and yet he keeps winning states. Democrats keep delivering symbolic victories for Bernie Sanders, even when the race is basically over. I don't think that says good things about Hillary Clinton. There's usually kind of a rallying effect once you see the presumptive nominee emerge. So there is certainly a split in the Democratic Party right now, and Bernie Sanders has put that on display more than anybody, including, you know, Howard Dean, including Elizabeth Warren in recent years. He's made that clear. I think the difference is that Republicans are willing to nominate Donald Trump to make their point and to try to change the direction of the party. Democrats are maybe not willing to nominate like somebody like Bernie Sanders, but they're certainly willing to make a point. And so they want him to go to the convention and have a voice. They want Hillary Clinton to be a progressive Democrat in the White House. And that's what they're saying with these votes. And apparently he's going to do a whole lot of winning before this whole thing is said and done, because the end of the calendar also looks very friendly for him.
For all the talk about the Republicans who might sit home in November, is there a sense that maybe many Bernie Sanders supporters could sit home in November? I think of what happened in 68 when a lot of Eugene McCarthy people refused to come along to Hubert Humphrey, and that could have cost him in a close election. I know this is still May and we have a long way to go to November, but Sanders supporters in November, something to worry about?
Yeah, I think insofar as young people may not come, you know, young people who were excited about Sanders and who maybe had been excited about Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, if they don't come out for Clinton, that's a problem for her. And I think that's the biggest risk of a drop-off between now and the general election. So I expect you'll see plenty of parsing of just how excited young people are about Hillary Clinton, because that's the one demographic that is really excited about Bernie Sanders and really stood by him, but also tends to really drop off in turnout when they don't have something to come out and vote that they're excited about. So certainly keep an eye on that going forward. As for the rest of the people who are voting for Sanders, I think it's probably likely that they'll come around and support the Democratic nominee in the general election.
Aaron Blake is a reporter and editor for The Washington Post, and he's on Twitter at AaronBlakeWP. Aaron, it's great having you on the show again.
Thank you, Ken. Good to be here as always.
And you know, the next time I'm going to play all the things you said wrong and remind you of that the next show.
I told your producer to actually burn the tape of this once it goes up on the internet. So you'll have to figure out a way to take that, you know, off of the website there.
Yeah, I don't think that's happening. Thanks, Aaron.
Take care.
For all the talk about contested conventions, it looks like both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will be crowned as their party's all but official nominees after June 7th, when voters in California and five other states have their say. Californians are noticeably excited about the prospect of being part of the conversation this year. Usually the battles for the nomination are long over by the time it gets to the Golden State. But there's not much excitement going on the other big race that day, the Senate contest to succeed Barbara Boxer, a liberal Democrat who is retiring after four terms. California's unique electoral system has every candidate, regardless of party, on the same ballot, and the top two finishers, regardless of party, advance to the general election in November. Kathleen Decker is a political columnist for the Los Angeles Times and joins us to handicap the primary. Kathleen, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The last time we discussed this race was about a year ago, and at the time, Kamala Harris, the state attorney general, was the odds-on favorite to succeed Boxer. Has anything happened that would challenge that assumption?
Not much. It's been a race that's really been overshadowed by the presidential contest, even in California, which hasn't voted yet, as you noted. There's been a certain stasis. We did some polling back at the end of March, which showed almost the same exact results as polling the year before. So Harris remains the front runner at this point. She has another major Democrat and three major Republicans behind her, but she seems a sure bet to make the runoff for November.
Tell me a little bit about her. I mean, I know she's attorney general. She's African-American. She seems to be the party's anointed candidate. But tell me a bit about her.
She certainly is. She's been a, you know, sort of a star on the rise in the Democratic Party for a long time. She ran for election as attorney general, squeaked into office in 2010 and was reelected in 2014 and has been essentially had her eye on higher office ever since then. Toward the end of a really non-contested race in 2014, she spent a couple million dollars on advertising in Los Angeles, which was clearly not intended to impress Los Angeles voters about her AG stripes, but was intended to lay a groundwork of knowledge about her for a future race. And with Boxer's announcement in early 2015 that she was not going to seek re-election, Harris was the first one in, and she's tried to build on that platform ever since. She's been a fairly progressive as policy matters go. Attorney General has worked to, for example, get settlements in the case of for-profit colleges and home mortgages, that crisis that came out of the 2008 recession. But she's also a very careful politician, and the latter has really sort of formed the bulk of this base in combination with the sort of overriding attention given to the presidential campaign. When you have a front runner who doesn't really want a whole lot of attention and doesn't really want to rock the boat, you get a certain, you know, tone of the race that is quieter than you might have otherwise.
It looks like her top competitor is a fellow Democrat, Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez from Santa Ana. How is Sanchez trying to rock the boat?
Sanchez is a much more quirky personality, certainly, as anybody who's been on her Christmas card mailing list for years, where she tends to appear with cats and motorcycles. So she's definitely sort of the antithesis of Harris in terms of that personality. She is arguing in the race that California can't afford somebody who needs, as she puts it, on-the-job training in Washington. She's pushing her 20 years of history in Congress as making her attuned to the issues and the policies that are going to come immediately before the next senator. The downside for her at this point is that the California Democratic Party is predominantly a Northern California party, and it's a predominantly Northern California female party. So that's been a sort of a log for Sanchez to have to jump over here. Southern California has a lot of population when you look at the state, but it doesn't have the bulk of voters. It has voters who tend to be somewhat lackadaisical about showing up. So that's been a problem for her. Ironically, though, the Trump phenomenon in California, even though the Republican contest is over, may have some influence on her results, because Trump's presence in the race has spawned a huge number of registrations by Latinos in California, and Latinos are the base of Sanchez's support. So if it turns out that, you know, as we suspect right now, he is on the ballot in November, if she is in the runoff, it's not too much to think that there could be a high turnout of Latinos voting against him who hang around to vote for her. So there's a sort of an interesting byplay there between the two races.
You were talking earlier about what kind of a quirky candidate Loretta Sanchez is, and I hate to bring this up, but I just remember the when she got herself into this little trouble when she mimicked a Native American war cry, when she seemed to confuse an Indian American with an American Indian. And of course, being who I am, and because this is the Political Junkie, I am going to replay that piece of tape.
He says, I come from the Indian American community. I'm thinking, great. He goes, when can we meet? So I'm going to his office thinking that I'm going to go meet with, blah, 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 right? Because he said Indian American. And I go in there, and it was great.
I remember thinking at the time that that was going to be the end of the Sanchez campaign, but she's still there, isn't she?
Right. And the irony is that that was essentially at her coming out party at last year's state Democratic convention. And since then, she also has gotten into some hot water by quoting statistics that suggest that up to 20% of Muslims are interested in terrorism. So that's the downside of a candidate who speaks her mind, is that you can get these sort of incidents that make campaign managers turn pale. And I'm not sure, though, the question still remains, in a state this large, whether that has made a dent at this point. People who know her and support her, I think, you know, part of that support is knowledge of her personality and knowledge that there are going to be circumstances like this that crop up every once in a while, but they find her compelling nonetheless. Certainly Harris supporters are not going to find that compelling, but a lot of Californians simply don't know these personalities well enough to make any judgment on it.
You know, it's funny. We always talk about how much we hate scripted candidates, and we wish these candidates would be more, you know, quirky. And yet, you know, Harris is very careful, and she's doing fine. And every time Sanchez does something quirky, she gets, raked in the coals by the media.
Well, I think the trick is, in a perfect candidacy, of which, of course, there aren't any, the trick would be to be quirky without offending voter groups, because that would tend to hit the sweet spot, I would think, now.
No Republican has won a Senate race in California since Pete Wilson in 1988. I know there are three Republicans running this year. Who are they?
Two former party chairmen. One is named Duff Sundheim. The second is Tom Del Vaccaro. And the third candidate, who just jumped into the race about a month or two ago, is Ron Unz, who you may remember ran against Pete Wilson in 1994 in a governor's primary, did not succeed. None of them is particularly well-known or well-funded at all, and that's been part of the problem for Republicans in getting that second slot in the runoff. Were there just one candidate for the party to rally around, it would have at least mathematically been easier, although they certainly would have had to mount some sort of campaign. But when you have sort of three little-known candidates, none of whom have access to large sums of money at this moment to make their case, there's a potential for dividing what is already a minority party and making all of them essentially in the low double digits and none of them surpassing Sanchez for that second slot.
Donald Trump keeps talking about the new voters he's bringing into the process, the new Republicans. Now, of course, the Republican presidential race is all but over by now, and perhaps if it was still competitive, maybe there'd be more attention on Republican turnout on June 7th. But does Trump being in the race and the kind of candidate, the kind of voters he attracts, might that help the Republicans running for the Senate in some way, or you don't think so?
I think it was certainly more possible had it been a fully competitive race. There will be some voters, certainly, who come out to support Trump and hang around to vote in the Republican Senate race. But I think the propensity of that would have been much higher had we had an active race where Cruz and Kasich and Trump were all going down, you know, to the last day in a competitive manner. I think that most Republicans here feel like their chances of really getting a higher turnout than Democrats on June 7th have lessened substantially. Again, there may be some. It also may be that we get a little fewer Democrats because of the tenor of the Democratic race at this point in time. So nobody is quite sure. There were a lot of Republican hopes that regardless of whether they supported Trump in the presidential race, they hope to benefit from his presence and his pull among less than regular voters to come out and help some of the Republicans running down ballot, because Republicans are less than 3 out of 10 voters in California right now. So any boost in their turnout helps them against Democrats, and particularly when we're talking about a top two situation where they could be aced out of the entire November race if things don't go their way. So there is some consternation that what Republicans thought would be a really high turnout is probably not going to end up that way. But there's still, I think, the possibility that it ends up being higher than normal.
I saw that all five candidates were debated on Tuesday night of this week. Was there anything memorable about the debate?
The frustration factor in watching it, I think, was the most memorable thing. This was a debate of five candidates, 1 hour, automatically, you know, sort of puts the crimp in things. And the organizers were very intent on having everyone answer for 1 minute and then stop them. There was very little of the sort of candidate-to-candidate byplay that illuminates both policy positions and character and, you know, personal attributes and all those things. We've seen in the presidential debates this year, particularly on the Republican side, when there were so many candidates competing, that it tends to lose focus a little bit and become something of a muddle. So there was some of that. I mean, it was also striking that what you usually see in a race where you have an acknowledged front runner in a debate like this is that everybody goes after the front runner. And that was not the case. Harris did come in for criticism by Sondheim, one of the Republican candidates, who criticized her virtually every time he had a chance to speak. But the other candidates really didn't do a whole lot. Sanchez had sort of a backhanded remark about how I didn't need to lift my finger in the wind to support the $15 minimum wage increase, which was aimed at Harris, but she didn't say it was aimed at Harris, so a casual observer may not have gotten that connection. So it was sort of an oddly unfocused debate, both in terms of the format of it, which was frustrating, and also in terms of the fact that everyone seemed to stay in their individual lane more or less. Harris was able to pretty casually deflect some of the criticisms that came her way, and it didn't appear to change in any, you know, dramatic fashion the sort of trajectory of the race.
Yeah, I was looking for an interesting soundbite from the debate, and this is what I came up with.
So we need to get a mic check from each one of you. Let's start with you, Mr. Del Beccaro.
Mary had a little lamb. Her fleece was white as snow.
Mr. Unz.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3.
Congresswoman Sanchez.
And everywhere that Mary went, that lamb was sure to go.
Attorney General Harris.
Kumbaya, my lord. Kumbaya.
And Mr. Sondheim.
There's no way I can.
That pretty much sums it up, don't you think?
Well, there were some good lines that followed after that, but it gets to some of the tone, that's for sure.
Kathleen Decker is a political columnist for the Los Angeles Times. She's on Twitter at Kathleen Decker, Kathleen with a C. Kathleen, it was great talking to you.
Great talking to you too, Ken.
All the leaves are brown. All the leaves are brown. And the sky is gray. And the sky is gray. I've been for a while. On a winter's day. On a winter's day.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, in light of the endorsements in Indiana of Donald Trump by two former college coaches, Bobby Knight and Lou Holtz, who was the last college sports coach who was elected to Congress? The answer, Tom Osborne of Nebraska. The great football coach for the Cornhuskers for a quarter century, Osborne was elected to the House from Nebraska's 3rd District in 2000 and served 3 terms. And the randomly selected winner is Stephanie Healy of somewhere. She's coming from an undisclosed location. As soon as Stephanie tells me where she lives, she'll get that button. That's how it works on The Political Junkie. Sorry, Stephanie. And we have a Scuttlebutt puzzle winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or a concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The first button was a picture of a Model T Ford car with the words "For President." Obviously a Ford for President button. But if you focused on Ford, you would have been wrong. Anyway, the next button had the words "Re-elect Senator Greenleaf" on a leaf. He's from Pennsylvania. Then a New Jersey button that read, Column E, Save Hudson County, as if anyone could save Hudson County. And finally, a Joe Arena for Congress button from Maryland. So when you combine car, not Ford, but car with leaf, with the letter E, and arena, you kind of get Carleafy Arena, the former running mate for Ted Cruz. And the winner is Elizabeth Carr of Port St. Lucie, Florida. What's the odds of someone named Carr winning this week's puzzle, right? As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttlebutt puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Maybe you could drive my car. Guess I'm gonna be a star.
It's time for This Week in Political History. Bob Bennett, a former Republican senator from Utah, died last week at the age of 82. He was one of the Senate's least known but most influential members. Elected 3 times by increasing margins, he was never one to jump in front of the TV cameras or seek publicity. He was a behind-the-scenes kind of guy whose counsel was widely sought by members of both parties. There was just one problem, or make that 2. First, he worked with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden on legislation to provide universal health care coverage. And second, he supported President Bush's $700 billion TARP bailout bill in 2008, saying it was necessary to save the nation's financial system. When the Tea Party started to make its presence felt in 2010, Bennett was one of its first targets. And he became one of its first victims 6 years ago this week. Here he is at the May 2010 Republican State Convention talking about his conservative principles and making his case for a 4th term.
I've been strengthened and stimulated by your passion for America, for the conservative cause, and the seriousness of the problems we face. I hear you when you say you want a fighter who will reflect that passion, telling the world that Utahns love their country and are deeply concerned about its future. I know you want to repeal Obamacare, and I agree. Indeed, I want to repeal Obama. By voting for me, you will be telling the rest of the nation that Utahns have not been taken in by the special interest groups who've tried to take over this campaign. Utahns reject the doomsayers and the fearmongers who say this country will fall. Utahns have not lost their faith in the future because Utahns remain convinced that God will continue to bless America. That's what I believe. That's what I believe. That's where I stand. And I ask you to stand with me. Thank you very much.
But ultimately, it was to no avail. Even though he brought in Mitt Romney to campaign for him, he finished third at the convention, getting only 26% of the delegate support. By coming in third, he was not eligible to participate in the primary, so he was gone. Speaking to reporters after the results were announced, Bennett didn't sound surprised, but he was emotional.
The political atmosphere obviously has been toxic, and it's very clear that some of the votes that I have cast have added to the toxic environment. I offer my congratulations, as I say, to whoever wins. But I assure him he will not have any more loyal, dedicated, or efficient staff than I have had.
Dan Harry is the political editor at the Salt Lake Tribune and covered Senator Bennett's career for years. I spoke with Dan in 2014, and here is that interview. You think of all the votes Bob Bennett cast over the years, it's hard to think of him as anything other than a strong conservative.
Definitely. Bob Bennett had a reputation of being a conservative. He lived up to it. He always had very strong rankings as a conservative, and he never really deviated from that. The one thing that Bob Bennett did do was he tried to reach across the aisle and do some bipartisan legislation every once in a while. And occasionally that got him in trouble, especially in the more recent, in the latter years of his tenure in the Senate.
I was going to say that once upon a time, I mean, for the longest time, Bob Bennett didn't seem to have any electoral problems at home. But come 2010 and come the rise of the Tea Party, reaching across the line wasn't very helpful to his career.
No, in fact, that was his biggest vulnerability. And just, you know, it was a circumstance of timing, I think, for Bennett, where the rise of the Tea Party just coincided with the Utah convention and caucuses that year, where the system that we have in Utah is very much dominated by strong, zealous Republican insiders. And that turned out to be the end for Bob Bennett.
Was it TARP and the health care reaching across with Senator Wyden, or was it also generational? I mean, was he the fact that he was in office for too long?
Yeah, I think that was part of it as well, that he had been painted by the Tea Party as part of the problem rather than the solution. And indeed, you know, he'd been there for three terms. So it's hard for someone in his position to say, you know, I didn't have anything to do with what just happened, you know, with the government, the meltdown of the financial system. That's not on my hands. It was very hard for him to make a convincing case that was true.
Obviously, in a state like Utah, whoever wins the Republican nomination, it's tantamount to victory. So obviously what happened at the state convention was extremely important. Were you surprised by the results? When I listened to Senator Bennett afterwards, I don't know if he sounds surprised, but he certainly sounded very emotional and hurt.
He was emotional and hurt. I mean, it was a guy that had served what he thought very honorably the state. And I don't think he was surprised. We weren't surprised. We had done polling for months showing that he was in big, big trouble. And it was interesting that, you know, here was a guy that was an incumbent that had all this establishment support. He had no trouble raising money, but he didn't seem to take it seriously enough early on. He hadn't done enough to really show that he was listening to the complaints about him. I think it was too easy for him to sort of brush it off as a minority vocal point of view that really wasn't going to affect the election. Obviously, that wasn't true.
Speaking of being in office too long, Orrin Hatch has been in the Senate since 1977. Wouldn't that argument extend to him, too?
Well, it has, and he got a lot of that in his last election in 2012. Orrin Hatch, unlike Bob Bennett, was prepared for sort of a Tea Party backlash, and he spent a record amount of money trying to secure the nomination and get through the caucuses and the convention, which he successfully did. He faced a primary, but won that quite easily. And in the course of that, though, promised that he would not seek another term after this, that this would be his final term. So we'll see if that's still the case when the time is up.
Dan Harry is a political editor at the Salt Lake Tribune. Dan, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Ken.
It was 6 years ago this week, on May 8, 2010, that Senator Bob Bennett, a three-term conservative Republican from Utah, was defeated for renomination at his party's state convention in Salt Lake City. His successor, Mike Lee, is now one of the leaders of the Tea Party in the Senate. And Bennett himself died on May 4th of this year. He was 82 years old. And for the record, he was a friend of ours. He was a really good guy. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. I'd like to send a special thanks to Neil Conan, who hosted the program last week in my absence. If I'm not mistaken, Neil was hosting the show as Donald Trump was celebrating Cinco de Mayo by eating a taco, and also wondering why Ted Cruz's father wasn't implicated in the Kennedy assassination. Can't make this stuff up. Neil, thanks so much. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.